once you study that article by Dick Turin, and it's technically it's called the reflective ground plane antenna range technique. If you're smart enough, you use that ground reflection in your favor as opposed to in your detriment, if you're smart enough to do that. And basically it means that the illuminating antenna, normally a guy quite frequently will test the antenna on the test in the receiving mode, and he's transmitting a signal toward it from some distance away on his antenna range. Let me drop.
And Dick, I just wanted to make sure, this will cover both the corner reflector or the flat face bow tie, correct?
I'm talking about any kind of VHF or UHF antenna. Everything from as simple as a dipole to as elaborate as a Yagi interphased array. Any kind of VHF, UHF antenna. No matter what the hell the antenna is, on any reasonable antenna range, the ground reflection is there, even though you don't think it's there. There are guys who think that, well, I'll get around the ground reflection by getting far away from the ground. And you set up one transmitter on a 15-story building and the receiver on another 15-story building half a mile away. And you think that now because you're 15 stories up and you're way away from the ground, you think you've eliminated the ground reflection. You've definitely attenuated it. You haven't eliminated it. It's still there. And so by way of this reflective ground plane antenna range, whenever you're on an outdoor antenna range, unless you've got $1 zillion where you can lay down a tremendous number of pieces of anechoic material on the ground, so the ground becomes thoroughly absorptive. If you've got $1 million to invest, and you put down Emerson Cumming Ridge Ram, and you put down in each square foot of it, that's a couple of $100, and you put down an acre of that stuff, if you've got the money to do it, yeah, now you've eliminated the ground reflection per se. Very few of us can do that. Let me drop. So in the real world, I don't care if it's a quarter reflector, a bow tie, a dipole, a phased array, a collinear array, a bunch of ground planes, a bunch of 5/8, no matter what VHF, UHF antenna, outdoors you're going to be measuring in the vicinity of ground plane reflection. By way of that article I'm describing, which is a well-kept secret, it's been there for 20 years, and very few people know it's there. That end of the chapter of transmission lines and antenna testing in the ARL antenna book, you read that Dick Turin article, you'll end up putting the illuminating antenna, the transmitting antenna, some number of feet away, and you'll be putting that transmitting antenna almost laying on the ground, opposite of common sense. And you recognize the fact that the ground reflection is giving you some peaks and valleys in the vertical plane at the area of measurement when you're doing the receiving on the antenna under test. And you're going to put your antenna under test in the middle of one of those vertical lobes. And what you're really doing when you're doing that, the article doesn't explain it, is you're setting up the transmitting antenna so low to the ground at just the right chosen number of feet above the ground, so that when the antenna on the test is looking toward the transmitting antenna, it's seeing the real antenna above the ground, it's seeing a mirror image of the antenna below the ground. And if you get the two close enough together, because your transmitting antenna is so close to the ground, it is inside of the 3D beamwidth of the antenna on the test, and it can't resolve the two. And when you set up the geometry just right, the reflection from the ground and the direct signal are in phase with each other, and part of the calibration procedure. So the real good antenna ranges, the professional antenna ranges, are doing that. There's a whole lot of advantages to doing it once you understand what you're doing. And it requires no tremendous amount of extra hardware and expensive hardware in order to do this. And so once you're setting up an outdoor antenna range, if you're trying to make a quantitative measurement of gain or pattern, I recommend you do this. I wonder how many times you've heard about that Dick Turin article at the back of the antenna book, at the back of the chapter on transmission lines and antenna testing. I'll bet you haven't heard it very often, except here in the segment, have you, John? And as I said, it's been there for 20 years. 82 WTV, 82 RIW in the segment.
Right again, Dick. Dick Turn, I've heard the name. All right. So it's in the chapter. Antenna test. Okay, and cable. All right. So at least he has a place to go to get some research and to, because there's very little information on setting up an antenna range easily. Now, when you say the transmitting antenna low to the ground, are you talking about quarter wave, half wave? How close to the ground?
If I was doing the measurement...
NY2HF would have come in.
NY2HF, recognize. We're going to get to you in a second. If I was doing the measurement, John, at 10 gigahertz, where the illuminating antenna transmitter was a small 15 dB gain feed horn, you would lay the feed horn on the ground. And I'm not kidding. How many wavelengths is there between the transmitting antenna and the ground? I could call it zero wavelengths because it's laying on the ground. Or if I looked at the phase center of the middle of the horn versus the upper surface of the ground, and they're separated by 2 inches, it's 2 wavelengths away from the ground, so to speak, phase center to ground. But so in that case, very, very close. In the case of a 2 meter good antenna range, one of the things you worry about with an antenna range is that in every realistic environment, you've got the trees off to one side, you've got the gutters of the house, the guys about moving, you've got particular things around that knew that the guy standing there somewhere. If the illuminating antenna has the highest gain you can get, which on VHF frequencies is probably a Yagi, if your illuminating antenna is a Yagi, which has now got, let me pick a number, a 25 degree beamwidth, so if you can see the pattern coming out of your illuminating antenna, your transmitter, it's a it's only got 25 degrees of beamwidth, and therefore it's lighting up very little of the It looks like he's got a display in red, green, yellow, blue. In other words, he's got multiple displays for, I guess, one of those displays is probably the peak positive hold, the other display is the peak negative hold, the other one is the sampling hold of a particular spectrum. See, you're going to have to make a photograph of multiple colored spectrum, John.
Yeah, Dick, and I can display, I believe, 3 separate displays at one time. Well, the next thing I wanted to ask you, I had 2 questions I forgot tonight. A return loss bridge, the directional coupler, what's the difference?
I think it's only words. In actual physical function of what's going on, return loss bridge, well, I take it back. A Wheatstone-like bridge has a minimum of 6 dB insertion loss on the so-called straight-through port to the device of the test, whereas a real directional coupler, depending on whether you're willing to use a 10 dB or a 20 dB directional coupler, you can make the insertion loss to the device of the test a small fraction of 1 dB. So, except for insertion loss, function-wise, they're very similar. Over to you, John.
Okay, because Rigel has a directional bridge which only works on the 1.5 gig unit. It will not work, they say, on the 3, but it would work if you account for the loss. But it only has a 2 dB loss, which is not really that great, but... My Nardas have a lot less, that's for sure. But I was just wondering, because I think they're the same.
The best way to put it is the theory of operation is strongly similar between the two. There's a whole kind of lots of ways that you can set up something that looks like a Wheatstone bridge, or a thing that looks like a directional coupler, or a thing that looks like a quadrature hybrid, or a thing that looks like a Wilkinson hybrid. But in any of those cases, you put the device of the test as a load, and if the load is a perfect 50 ohms, you get no signal coming back, and it's null. Any non-null tells you how far away from the 50 ohm resistor is your load. So in all cases, devices, it really is looking at reflected power from a 50-ohm transmission line point of view. If your load is a pure 50-ohm resistor and your transmission system acts somewhat like a 50-ohm coaxial cable, then in theory there's no reflection and there's no signal to see. It's null, and you know it's perfect. And any non-perfection of that null gives you a signal, and the magnitude and or phase angle of that signal tells you what exactly is the amount of error in that load. Over to you, John, KQLIW.
Well, maybe soon they'll be making a vector network analyzer, but this one is a network analyzer where they showed some demonstrations on that were pretty impressive. So I have all the directional couplers, so I think I'm going to be able to make some interesting measurements.
A vector network analyzer really is a tracking signal generator into something that is a phase-sensitive spectrum analyzer. Okay? Therefore, a spectrum analyzer with a built-in tracking generator into a good directional coupler is, properly hooked up, a scalar network analyzer. And if you can, by some magic, force the measurement of the spectrum analyzer to also be phase-sensitive, and there's not two difficult ways you could do that. You can make your tracking SIGGEN plus spectrum analyzer do essentially everything does that a vector network analyzer does. The only difference between a vector network analyzer and your instrument is the phase sensitivity. Once you add the directional couplers, your machine is a scalar network analyzer. Over to you, John.
Okay, that's something in the demonstration they didn't express. They were very positive in telling you that you cannot measure phase, but they didn't mention the fact of adding a directional coupler or anything like that. They said you can do everything network analysis that you need to do, but it's not a vector network analyzer. So I will be talking to you about that when I get it.
Yeah, two-thirds of the time, John, you don't need phase. Scalar network analyzer, two-thirds of the time, tells you everything you want to know. When you and I are adjusting that antenna to know that it's got a 1.75 ISWAR and it's got a 14 dB reflection coefficient in magnitude, which is a scalar number, that's everything you want to know. To know that its mismatch is a little bit capacitive versus inductive, there's a zillion ways you can find that out independently. You know, by taking a tuning tool and putting it near the driven element and adding some capacitance to the tip of the element, and does the ISWAR get better or worse? It tells you right away. It's the blind man walking up a hill, and he's immediately knowing whether or not he's walking up the hill or down the hill. Over to you, John.
Yeah, I've made a few of those. I call them my magic wands. I've took the dowels, like you suggested, and put some copper tape on them. I've had aluminum tape on them, and it really does work, and you can actually look at the difference. The only problem is you have to be near the antenna to do that, which has a minor effect on it, but it's very interesting how that works.
If you've got a long enough stick and a big enough piece of foil at the end of the stick, your presence doesn't matter, John. And as you wave it near the tip of the dipole of a driven element of a Yagi, for instance, and then you wave it near the junction in the center of the driven element, in one case you're adding capacitance, in the other case you're doing an inductive-like function. You can, as long as you know what you're looking at, it tells you with 90% information, so to speak, what's happening and which way you got to go to make it better.
Well, I've actually seen that effect with my vector network analyzers. I took what you had suggested. I took a piece of copper tape and I grounded it onto the fitting and then put the scotch tape on the antenna metal part and stuck the copper on there to make it a capacitor. And I could actually see the capacitance effect as I peeled it back. I bent it back 180 degrees for about an inch, and then I slowly pulled it straight down, and I could see the capacitance changing as it came down. Fantastic.
And after you peel back the tape from the scotch tape, and it's now up in the air, so to speak, at a 90 degree degree angle, and you take your little stick with nothing on the end of it, and you start remotely pushing the copper tape back down onto the scotch tape, which is making the capacitor increase, and you watch the screen, and somewhere in there you're going to say, hey, that's the spot I want, that's the right amount of capacitance, and you'd be amazed how high Q a capacitor that is. You could transmit up to a watt with that, John. KQLIW.
Well, I actually watched it on my spectrum analyzer, and I was looking at the Smith chart, and I could see the dot return to the center. When it needed capacitance, luckily it didn't need inductance because I had nothing to put on there at the time. But the capacitance, I could actually see the dot move around, and it doesn't take much of peeling back or adding to do it. It's just a fantastic piece of information.
Yep. When you're doing that kind of tweaking, like a ham radio operator loves to do, tweaking with tuning tools while watching the screen, you can do 30 antenna experiments in a day. You do it by a computer modeling program, and you really add all of the data into the model. I'll be amazed if you can get 3 or 2 models in the computer and get in results in a day. And the result you get on the computer is in the right direction, but you still got to do post-computer optimization. You eventually still have to build the real thing. You can find a hell of a lot of very good antenna designs if you're smart enough by tweaking, and you're way ahead of the game from modeling. Most of the antenna companies in the United States have a burned-in philosophy. We model it first, then we build it. As such, almost every one of the antenna designs I have patented, they could have never found any one of them. Over to you, John, K2LAW.
Well, that follows the impetus for research, actual research, doing it freehand. And I found out another thing. When I would work on an antenna, I would have it on maybe a 6-foot stepladder, and I would tune it, and then I would walk over to it and put it on a pole and raise it maybe to 12, 15 feet. It would have to be adjusted again, and that's another thing that you can play with, and it's really easy to do, and you can get it almost dead on. By the time you put it up to 35 feet or whatever, there's not going to be that much difference. That's what I've found so far.
Yeah, when I was building ideal 19-element Yagis on 432, and my antenna range had them mounted, about 7 feet off the ground, on poles, and I would stand up on a wooden step ladder to be near it with these tuning tools. Once I tuned that Yagi to my perfection, so to speak, if I raised the antenna another 7 feet, the change in tuning was very minor. Only if you're looking at the very fine details. And if you think that, if you're just tuning an antenna for Viswar and it's a Yagi, aim it straight up in the air. And only the back lobe is looking at the earth, so to speak. So there are various ways you can get around when it comes to Viswar tuning of a Yagi-like antenna. You can almost eliminate the ground reflection as being a major factor. Over to you, John.
Yes, when I was using Yagis, I did exactly what you said. I put the driven elements pointing straight up, and that's how I tuned them. And, the ground made very little difference. But even so, when you do elevate it, and you look at it again on the VNA, there is a difference. You will see that little bit of capacitance shift or inductive shift. Usually it's capacitance. You need a little more capacitance as you take it up.
What's really happening is...
coming.
Okay, I'll get to you in a second. What's really happening is that a little bit of the antenna radiated signal as a side lobe in elevation for a horizontal Yagi located horizontally above the ground, horizontally polarized Yagi, a little bit of the side lobe is going straight down. When it reflects off the ground, it comes up in phase or out of phase. Depending on the altitude of that Yagi above the ground, that reflection is either adding capacitance or inductance. It's a function of how many wavelengths. I'll go ahead with a comment, KQLIW.
chemistry is invented by artistic modeling, same as you're referring to by as Ham should. D3, said he said.
Yeah, you're right, Scott. And what's unique about the antennas that I was building is that, I'll have to find that patent number for you to look it up. In fact, I know where to go. While I'm talking, I'm going to get you that patent number. And what I'm getting at is that you can go to, simply Google the word US and then a number, which really is going to be the patent number, which I'm getting you. You'll get a picture of that particular patent, of that particular three-element sheet metal Yagi antenna. Okay, I'm getting closer to it. All right. It's sent mail, found that. I'll eventually find the guy who I sent this thing to. What I'm getting at is that the elements of the antenna are so extremely wide that if you try to computer model the antenna, let me drop it. What the computer model does is it takes your structure, something like your high-frequency structure simulator or your CST Studio, any of these modeling programs, take your device that is studying, break it up into a zillion little triangles, find finite elements, and it figures out amplitude and phase angle of the currents flowing through each one of those. Well, when you've got very wide elements of this patent I'm about to tell you about, I'll stop to look right now so I can keep talking. The program can't handle it. It can't invert a matrix with that many terms to it. It would be something like a 60 by 60, 64 by 64 matrix, and it can't handle it. Therefore, the computer program cannot model that antenna. And I've gone to a couple of real good computer modeling experts of antennas, and I said, okay, try. How close can you get? And they did do some modeling, and it showed the trend, but it didn't really show you the performance the antennas really got. So there's a whole class of antennas, particularly when you get into metamaterials, which I've done some of that work also, where the modeling program just can't handle it. So we ham radio tweakers, have got one hell of an advantage. And I guess you're saying the early guys designing automobiles with clay, they really were ham radio tweakers. Is that what you're saying, Scott? K2RIW?
Amongst the best in all of the industries. So there you go. There's an artist in you somewhere.
Yeah, I'll be back in about a minute with a patent number. Stand by.
Hey, Scott. Nice to hear you in there tonight. KC2WQB.
Oh, I was enjoying this capacitive conversation here. The last 20 minutes here was really trucking along some interesting stuff. I had a lot of fun in my playing with antennas on the window and stuff like that. I have a piece of half-inch hardline that's cut to a quarter wave of 144. And, you know, just coming in and out of range of the antenna in the window changes the noise quarter incredibly. Now it's acting as a reflector, capacitively coupled reflector, but you know, 6.6 inches back at it, anywhere within perpendicular to 15 degrees left or right, can it cause a weak signal to be heard very clearly. So I know what you guys are speaking of.
Well, Scott, I just find the antennas fascinating because some of the ugliest antennas I've ever seen work so well. It's just hard to explain, or it's hard to imagine explanation. But why? You look at it and say, that can't work, and it does. So, yeah, without experimenting, without trying different things, you really don't know. So that's good. You're doing great stuff.
Yeah, I found down the number. Write down this number. 7205953. 7,205,953. You Google that number with U.S. in front of it. USPTO, I think. I just go and Google it with U.S. And I think it comes up with a patent. I'll soon find out. Over to you, Scott.
Visuar versus frequency, 1.05 to 1 maximum Visuar,
from 902 to 928. That's the main nature of the patent. Other than that, how in the world can this guy re-patent a Yagi 75 years later after Dr. Hinder Super Yagi? Over to you, Scott, KQLAW.
All right, okay. Gotcha. That's... okay. Well, very good. I'm sort of reading as we go here, and it's quite fascinating. got one for 144.
Not really. I will admit that the amount of sheet metal you'd use to build an equivalent for this for 144 would be not so practical. Although I guess it could be done. The nice thing about the sheet metal is that you could lay it flat to the ground, therefore it would have very low wind load. You'll notice if you look at the later illustrations, you'll notice that in the actual place where it's being used, the sheet metal started off flat, but then it's all burned, it's all bent around a cylindrical shape that's parallel to the boom. Take a cylinder, a large diameter cylinder parallel to the boom, and bend the elements around it. In the actual application, this thing became a rubberized coated piece of sheet metal hanging out in front of a handheld RFID reader, and the reader had a pistol grip to it. Let me drop. Had a pistol grip to it, so the back end of the... it looked like a handheld computer with a pistol grip coming out of the bottom of it. When you put the pistol grip on the ground and took the whole thing and tilted it forward, the two forward tips of the director with their curvature touched the ground, touched the table, that became a tripod. Lots of people saw this thing sitting on the table and said, that's the weirdest looking tripod I've ever seen. Where is the antenna? They were looking at the rubberized covering. They couldn't see the sheet metal inside. They said, that's a weird looking tripod. Where's the antenna? Over to you, Scott. KQLAW.
Question? Quick question?
Go ahead, quick question.
The ninth one is, well, it's two dimensions on an iPad screen, so I'm having, I guess, trouble with the projection, but I think I see where you're going. Yeah, tripod-esque, I guess, on a 2D drawing here. Most interesting. You said 1.05 across the band.
Yeah, question. I'll pick you up in a second. Yes, 30 dB reflection coefficient, 902 to 928 megahertz inclusive. That's a 1.05 or 1.03 standing wave ratio. It had to be that low for this application because the way an RFID reader works, it really is a CW radar. You're transmitting a signal somewhere in that frequency range, and you got to be hopping continuously to be license-free, so you're not interfering with other services. And as you transmit a signal, the RFID tag picks up the signal, reflects it back to you on the exact same frequency you're transmitting. But the time domain reflection, the time domain variation of the reflection coefficient is the digital code. It gives you 96 bits of information. So because you're receiving and transmitting on the exact same frequency, the visual reflection of your own antenna would jam your receiver if it wasn't 30 dB down. Does that make some sense, Scott? BE3ZTZ, KQLAW?
Yes, it does. Very much so. As soon as you, you probably said it, but it just came, as soon as you put it in context there, that piece came together. Thank you.
The person who said he got a question, go ahead.
This is K1MJM on Echolink from Chincoteague, Virginia. Just wondering, what was that patent number again? Can you come back to me with that patent number again? I missed it when you said what it was before.
Okay, Mr. MJM. And you and I have had an email, I think, back and forth once before. 7205-953. I'll repeat. 7205-953. And there's five different ways you can Google that, and you'll get a number of different responses, but most of them will show you a picture of this thing that we're talking about. QSL, MJM.
Roger that, Dick. K1MJM, roger that. By the way, Echolink is very slow today. It's a long pause before I get a chance to transmit back to you guys. So, okay, very good. I found it. Thank you very much. K1MJM listening.
Yeah. Isn't that a funny-looking piece of sheet metal? And who would ever think that you could stamp a piece of sheet metal like that, end up with a Yagi-like structure? To find that by a modeling program, I'm pretty sure you wouldn't live long enough. Let's see. I'm looking up your call letters right now on QSL. It's Michael. Oh, yeah. It says Trumbull, Connecticut. I guess you've also got a Virginia home as well as the one in Trumbull. Is that true, Michael? K1MJM, K2LIW.
Actually, I'm staying in Chincoteague right now. I'm spending my days at Wallops Island taking a rocket payload workshop.
My goodness, that sounds like fun. Sounds like good technical work. So, when somebody says to you, hey, that's not rocket science, you can say, yes, it is. Is that true, Mike?
Roger that, yes. It's a lot of fun. It's a seven-day class I'm taking down here. It's called Rock On. If you want to look it up, it's called Rock On, and it's, like I said, satellite payload. We're building a payload, and at the end of the week, we're going to launch it into space and retrieve it the same day. K1MJ, and back to you.
Very fancy, Mike. The thing you're going to launch, I'm going to guess it's going to be a suborbital launch. Is that true, Mike, and roughly how high up do you think it'll go?
The plan is 75 miles up. All it is, it's really a payload workshop, not so much a satellite workshop. So, yes, it's only going 75 miles up. It's a bunch of instruments, how to build the instruments, how to protect them from the environment, from the, you know, vibration, shock, all that kind of stuff. It's a Terrier Orion sounding rocket it's going up on. It sees 40 Gs, could see 40 Gs on launch. So, yeah, it is definitely suborbital. K1MJM.
Yeah, I think one of the definitions of the threshold of space is 100 kilometers, which is 62 miles. You're going up 75 miles. That's definitely going into space. And 40 Gs, I'm going to make a guess that that really is a solid-state booster. Is that true, Mike? K2RIW?
Yes, roger that. Both the booster and the rocket itself are both solid fuel propellant.
And 40 Gs. Wow. You're not going to put a human being through that. I think you can briefly put a human being through 9 Gs, although Colonel Staff on that rocket sled of his that was arrested by water, I think he did on occasion experience a 40 acceleration where his body was completely tied down, and I believe he had a temporary retina detachment when he did that. But if you've read any of those stories about this Colonel Stapp, S-T-A-P-P, I think was the spelling of his name, and he was doing that research, I believe, in the late 60s, in that order, finding out what could a human being tolerate. I wonder if you've ever read any of those stories of my K2LAW.
Yes, I have. I've seen the movie clip of it, too. It was very impressive, and if I remember right, he was bleeding out of everywhere when he came to a stop. So, yeah, he was not in good shape when he finished his little ride.
However, I believe he recovered from most of that, including the retina detachment. I think almost all of that he recovered. I think the guy is not a masochist. He did not want to permanently damage his body. Did you get that impression, Mike, K2LAW? Okay, I've got to go away. Bye bye, you all. And look out for those crazy shaped Yaggies. K2LAW.
Good night, Dick. Good night, Scott. KC2WGB.
Out of curiosity, John, did you get a chance to see that patent number displayed on your screen?
I'm trying to insert the number now. I'm coming up with an error, and it's asking me for a correction. I'm at the government patent office site, and it's not going through, but I'll try again. I definitely want to see it.
Yeah, the patent office is one way. There's a so-called quick search you can do there, which is one way, but simply Googling that number and putting in front of it U.S. or U.S.P. or U.S.PTO, U.S. Patent and Trademark Office is what that stands for. Just put a couple of letters in front of that number and simply Google that number. And most of the time, Google will find you two or three different places that will display the patent for you. Good luck with that, John. K2LAW.
Okay, Dick. I will try that. Good night and have a pleasant week. KC2WTV.
Yeah, I did it with U.S. and just the number, and it worked just fine. 73s, my friends. Pleasure as always listening. Appreciate what you do for Ham Nation on both sides of the border. B3ZZ out.
It's been quiet again. 32 in shipping.
Good morning, John. I gotta get used to you being on again in the morning. You were off for a while.
Yeah, you only hear me here in the morning. That's about it.
Oh, you mean you don't have welding equipment also? would have threw my little piece into the truck. I was told everything was ready to rock and roll. You just gotta install it. Okay.
So I'm sure that the higher-ups are really thrilled with the fact that Ben, I don't remember, he said 5 or 7 hours preparing this machine, and then it still had to be picked up.
As I said on the phone to them,
you should have picked it up from the get-go, but you don't want to listen. So there. You wasted all my time, your money, your fuel, wear and tear on the truck, to your ignorance. And I reminded them, ignorance is bliss. So what do they do in a situation like that? Put a new one on a truck and then swap them out?
Yes, affirmative.
Affirmative?
Yes.
Today is the start of the Javits Center. Yes, I got a nice big long harness to put into a machine and make that work again. So it'll bother me. I just sit there. Time allotted for that show's 4.5 hours. But the way I do them, I can get up done in about 2.5. And then I got a real nice job I gotta do. I gotta rebuild a whole entire pre-lift chain setup on a very big forklift. See if I... So, it just might be Javits Center at home today. Who knows? Who knows? But I am the man on call. And the phone didn't ring once over the weekend, which was a good thing. So if the time allotted for the job is 4.5 hours and you manage to be able to do it in 2.5, what happens with the other 2 hours, Johnny? Daily news, New York Post, get something to eat, relax. Oh, you mean you don't call the dispatcher and say, I finished 2 hours early, you got another job for me? When I was 25, I would do that, but no more. Okay. So how was that to you? Did you enjoy it? get a sale. You are getting a bargain. The only thing you got to do is every once in a while get a nice long ride. You get her up and back. I bring her up. She wants to come home for, when she comes home for the, on a holiday. She's going to check the airport. She's flying into Iceville for 125 hours round trip. In that case, the only time you have to do it is when you want to load everything into the truck to get her up there and get her back. Consider a laptop as far as the computer is concerned. Done deal. MacBook Pro. Already bought it. You get her own printer also? A Wi-Fi spot and all that nonsense. And I got her, four complete sets of, refills and all that garbage for it. So she's all set. Did you remember to buy her paper? I got a case that I can bring up there for her. Not that she'll need a case. She probably needs maybe two or three rings. That's it. Don't waste the room in the truck because the door moves aren't that big. Two rings is plenty. To buy any software for it because when I was on the phone with the school, they told me do not buy Microsoft Office, do not buy any antivirus for it. Just use the laptop, just go on a website, just download the download application, and then moving day, I have to go to the IT department with the laptop and they'll set up all the Wi-Fi stuff for it for. But she doesn't have to worry about internet, it'll automatically turn into the closest Wi-Fi spot. She's at the college, and there's Wi-Fi throughout the whole entire college. They do encourage putting a 25-foot internet cable for the dorm room, just in case the Wi-Fi changed in the dorm room. So, it is what it is. One more thing, I don't know how it works nowadays, but when I sent my boys up to school, the laptop that I had bought them, they were Dells at the time, all had spots on it that you could hook in a security cable. You might want to consider that for your daughter, because if you leave the laptop in the dorm room, when she leaves to go somewhere, it might not be there when she gets back.